Nuisance Properties Strategies Workshop. We are sponsoring this workshop today with our co-sponsors, our Aiken Council of Neighborhoods. And it's a delight not only to be with Beth and Ann and Gary today, but also to work so closely on issues that we all care so deeply about. This issue of code enforcement, property enforcement, is not only a unique challenge for us in Aiken, but I know that it is a unique challenge and a difficult challenge for municipal officials around the country. I'm delighted to have our friends from Aiken County present here this afternoon as well. And one of the reasons that we decided to hold this workshop was at the request of our City Council, Mayor Rick Osborne and Council Members Ebner, Duar, Price, and Diggs, who are here with us today, have made it very clear that they want to make sure that we are as effective as possible in addressing the concerns that our citizens have. Issues that really cut to the chase, really cut close to home, issues of quality of life in all of our neighborhoods. So in dealing with this challenge, we reached out to the South Carolina Municipal Association and said, you know, we've had some challenges in terms of code and property maintenance issues. Can you point us in a direction of communities that have been seen as communities of leadership in this area? And they very quickly mentioned three communities, Greenville, Rock Hill. So we invited representatives from those communities here today, and those two communities are represented, and through the mystery of technology, we're going to have representatives from the city of Clemson as well. The Municipal Association said clearly over the years, these three communities have really highlighted effective techniques in the area of zoning and property maintenance enforcement issues. And so that's the purpose of this meeting today. We are videoing this meeting. So we ask those in the audience that after the initial presentations, if you have questions for our panel, we would ask you to come forward. We all can hear you from where you sit in this room, but folks that might want to watch this thereafter would have difficulty if you don't come up to the podium, so we would appreciate you doing that. And the whole purpose of this is to educate ourselves about what other communities are doing. We had a tour this morning from 10 to 12 with our staff, along with the staff from two of the three communities, and we showed them some of the challenges that we face in the city of Aiken and asked for their input, their advice and guidance. We found that very, very helpful. So we really appreciate our guests for not only coming to Aiken to be with us today, but also sharing your experience and your advice and your guidance. Our speakers today include Attorney Jim Meggs, who in South Carolina is seen as one of the deans of city attorneys across the whole state. We've asked Attorney Meggs to appear before us on other issues, and we thought that we would ask Attorney Meggs to kind of set the stage in terms of what the latest cases are in our courts, what municipalities have the authority to do and not do. You know, out of frustration from time to time, we hear complaints from citizens and say, well, why don't you just go there and insist that within 24 hours they do A, B, and C. And the fact is we have to follow the laws, and Attorney Meggs is an expert in municipal law, so we've asked him to talk for 10 or 15 minutes just to briefly set the stage for us in terms of what municipalities actually have the power to do. And then we will will turn to our special guests from the city of Greenville. We have Brad Rice, who is the code enforcement supervisor. Obviously, Greenville being a much larger community, but he brings many years of experience, and we've already gotten to know Brad and really appreciate his perspective and his advice for all of us to effectively address some of the concerns of our citizens. And then we turn to our friends from Rock Hill, Robin Joas, who is the Housing and Neighborhood Services Department or Inspections Coordinator, and Jean Branch, who works in the Housing and Neighborhood Services Department. Once again, we've had several hours to talk to them, and we think that you'll find their testimony and their experience in Rock Hill very informative. And last but not least, we have Mr. Jacob Peabody, who's going to appear on the screen through Skype from his city, we're particularly interested in Clemson because we know that because of the location of the university, the issue of rental housing obviously is a very important issue to them. And when we look at the various ordinances that cities have, we notice that one of the toughest ordinances as it relates to rental housing that we have found is in the city of Clemson. And so we asked Jacob to be with us today to tell us about how his ordinances have worked in Clemson and what some of the challenges that they face in Clemson. So having said that, I want to get right to our presenters. As soon as we're done, we'd like to get through the major presentations, and then we'll open up to questions or comments from the Council of Neighborhoods, and then open it up for your comment as well. And we're not just having a meeting to have a meeting. It is our plan at the conclusion of this meeting to work with the Council of Neighborhoods to identify what ideas are intriguing and what ideas need to be pursued in Aiken. And we've been directed by our council to report back to them in the near future with a plan of action in that regard. So having said that, I'd like to introduce Attorney Jim Meigs.
There we go. It works. Can I set this timer up, John, so I'd be able to comply with your 15-minute time limit? Or I'm just going to start talking real fast, and you
take as long
push
as you
me along. Okay. Based on my conversations with your city attorney and your staff, I took it that I was probably going to approach this from a MOAB approach, that is, let's talk about the worst-case scenario, the demolition case. And there's a reason for that, principally because we do have a reported South Carolina case out of the city of Orangeburg, which I participated in as an expert witness. And there are some teaching points that come from the bad experience of Orangeburg in that case, but I think there's some fairly typical features and behaviors that were in the evidence that the jury frankly didn't like there. So, I've got this demo thing on my mind, and I'm not going to deal with the more subtle grass trimmings and such as that. Unless y'all would have me go there, I'll be happy to share with you whatever experiences I've had there. I was with Columbia for a total of 28 years, 25 as a full-time staff and city attorney, and then as a consulting lawyer for 3 years after my retirement in 2007. I'm currently the town attorney for the big town of Blythewood. And so we are having, the birth pains because we're just now getting into some of these things that, frankly, the little town hadn't had to contend with. So there's a fairly extensive history there. Okay, so to set your stage, what's the basis for codes, building codes in South Carolina, and other codes for that matter, zoning and what have you? all of our powers stem from the grant of the general police power in Title V of the South Carolina Code, and then we're going to work from Title V, the general grant of the police power, which of course deals with regulations affecting the general health, safety, welfare, and in fact in our statute it says in the convenience of the municipality, which sounds a little broad to me, but nonetheless that word is there. We have a number of different places in the code that we have to jump to find sources of authority for municipal regulations other than that general grant of police power in Title V. Specifically with regard to building codes, there are provisions in Title VI that have been on the books for a long time that used to grant permissive authority to cities and counties to adopt building codes. It was not mandated, but if you adopted a building code, it had to be a standard code promulgated by the then Southern Building Code Congress, now the International Code Congress, the ICC. This is a group that operates out of Birmingham, Alabama, and I think they get together about every 2 years, tweak their code, and then we have to buy new versions so they the revenue stream is assured. Nonetheless, the Title VI enabling statute has been changed over the years. It went from a permissive grant to a mandatory grant. City councils and county councils were required to adopt codes, and they had to be unaltered standard codes, either by the SBCC or the ICC. SBC, the Southern Building Code Congress, no longer exists. It's been absorbed into the ICC. A final morphing has occurred, and I question whether we have to adopt anything, and that, I guess that's a good question for the lawyers, because now state law says that we shall enforce. It doesn't say we'll adopt. The code says thou shalt enforce only the codes promulgated by the ICC as modified by the state codes council, a state agency sitting in Columbia, and they take the new versions of the ICCs, make certain modifications, and then basically cram those codes down on cities and counties in South Carolina. And we have no authority not to do anything but enforce what the code council says to enforce. An unfunded mandate of the highest order. So I've got this little question in my notes. Do we even need to adopt anything? The Title VI provisions give us the permissive authority to grant or to adopt other of the ICC promulgated codes. The mandatory codes are the building, gas, electric, plumbing, the typical codes. One of the permissive codes is the International Property Maintenance Code. I always want to say IMPC, but it's IPMC. International Property Maintenance Code, and I think I'm informed that all of the jurisdictions represented here today have adopted the IPMC. There's some problems with this thing, and if I have time, I'll try to identify those quickly, and I do want to spend, if you'll allow, some time with Gary, perhaps, to show him some of the problems that I have encountered with the IPMC, specifically with regard to demolitions. Okay. Permissive codes. Now, let me get my watch. Gosh, I've already talked for 10 minutes. Okay. One of the other interesting features of Title VI is there's a section there that says these authorities that we grant here are cumulative. So it would suggest that we can do other things. I don't know how you can reconcile that, but again, that's a good thought for the lawyers. Now, there's another area dealing with code enforcement matters in Title 31, and it's something that's been on the books since 1939. We used it in Columbia. It's a chapter entitled Dwellings Unfit for Human Habitation. So the provisions there relate only to dwelling structures, not commercial structures. And I'm going to recommend to you, counsel, that you consider looking at perhaps adopting an ordinance that follows the Title 31 track for dwellings unfit for human habitation. And I'd hazard a guess that most of the problems that you're dealing with in Aiken are dwelling units, not commercial structures, but again, that's just a wild guess on my part. There's some strengths in the Title 31 procedure that, frankly, you don't have in the IPMC. I am the IPMC. Okay. Zoning authority derives from a whole other area in Title 6. It's the Local Government Planning Enabling Act, and I'm not going to spend, because I don't have time, not going to spend a whole lot of or any time on zoning, other than to say it's two distinct sets of regulations with different processes and so forth. There is no authority in South Carolina law for a city or county to enforce covenants and restrictions in subdivision documents. So if you're like me and you live in a sub with a homeowners association that doesn't have any teeth, because we were formed in the early 80s before people really got educated in these matters, all we can do as a homeowners group is go knock on doors and ask for folks to please behave themselves. I think more modern covenants and restrictions have teeth, and you probably have some property owners associations in Aiken that have the authority to fine folks that don't comply with the mandates of the association. But there is no authority for this city to enforce private contractual covenant provisions between property owners. Now, there may be parallel city regulations that kind of bear on the same subject, and obviously you can pursue those, but you have no authority to do otherwise. Okay, and then we're all familiar with the property overgrowth enabling statute in Title V that gives us the authority to go on and cut property and lien it if the property is covered up with weeds or what have you. I know that there's going to be some interest in talking about the ability to regulate folks boarding up structures. That's a topic that's dealt with minimally in the IPMC. Columbia has tried a number of things over the years, including, I'm told, getting a grant last year, and they've gone and covered, and I don't know if they've done this with property owner permission or not, but we have a lot of absentee property owners in Columbia, and apparently a grant was procured, and we pulled OSB board and other coverings off of windows and replaced that with plexiglass so that the aesthetic aspect of the board up arguably is eliminated. Something you might want to check on. I'm going to quickly talk about this Orangeburg case, and hopefully I'll finish up in 5 more minutes. All right. There was some folks in Orangeburg back in the early 2000s, 03, professor and his wife bought a burned structure with the idea that they were going to renovate it. The last name is Chakrabarty. The case is Chakrabarty versus the City of Orangeburg. It's a 2013 opinion in the South Carolina Court of Appeals, opinion number 5126. this was a case that I felt resembled so much of the activity that I saw in my 25 years in Columbia, because the building official there, as I'm sure your building official, all of our building officials, the last thing we want to do is do a demolition. And the tendency is to accommodate and extend and accommodate and extend, and that's exactly what happened in Orangeburg, and it wound up costing the town $165,000. I don't have time to run through the chronology of communications, but it was just absolutely typical of the building official pushing. March 6, 2003, first notice. April 7, 2003, second notice. May 2004, another notice. August 2004, another notice. August 5th, another notice. You issue a uniform ordinance summons and tell them to come to court on September 13th, but in the meantime you've issued a demolition order that gives rise to some of these problems that I've mentioned tangentially with the International Property Maintenance Code. Numerous building permits were issued and revoked, and you've got to get an architect to bring us a sealed plan because you've been playing with this for 2 years, and it just went on and on and on. And ultimately, a jury found that the city had been grossly negligent in the administration of its code enforcement efforts. And again, my time didn't permit me to elaborate much further, other than to tell you that there are some real pertinent lessons from what went on in the Orangeburg case, and I would commend that to everyone's attention. Now, when I took this little assignment on, I thought I was going to be talking to the council, and I've learned now that this is a public session, and that's fine, and I stand by everything I've stated. But I've got some recommendations for the council that I'd like to share with you, and this again is in this demolition context, the worst case scenario context. Here are some of the lessons I think that come from the Orangeburg case. When the building official does the initial evaluation of a piece of property, if it's clear or certainly most likely that it's going to wind up in a demo track, then I would encourage the council to request that the staff take a fairly hard, high scrutiny look at a structure, and if it needs to get on a demo track, put it on a demo track, keep it on a demo track, and get the job done, get the ball over the goal line. That's going to require a commitment of resources. I think you have to assume that a lot of the money that you might appropriate for demolitions by the city you're not going to see again, and just assume that as a part of the cost of doing business. If you look at the Chakrabarty-Orangeburg case, you'll conclude, or you should conclude, that if a building permit is issued, you're going to be stuck with that situation for at least 2 years. I can't be more specific, and I'll share all the greasy details with Gary and show him exactly what I'm talking about. But if you issue a permit under the IPMC, you're going to be stuck with that problem for at least 2 years. And I'm not sure we have the authority to amend locally this thing to cure that. That's why I'm part of why I'm recommending that Title 31 procedure to you, because I don't think you have that problem if you follow that track. Third recommendation: if you've got a structure that's on the demo track, council, don't get involved. Let the staff run it. Take the ball, staff, get it over the goal line without interference. Don't mix demo notice processes up with the issuance of uniform ordinance summonses. That's what happened in part of what happened in Orangeburg. The Chakrabartis thought that they could go to the city court and have their day in court, or at least that was their position in the civil trial. Unfortunately, the house got demolished about 2 weeks before the trial date on the uniform ordinance summons. But there were conflicting sequences on the demolition order as opposed to the ordinance summons itself. All right. I can say from, you know, watching these things for my almost 30 years, I know it's common to have a complaint-driven system. And I assume that's probably what goes on in Aiken. In other words, if nobody calls, no action is taken. Get away from that. Get a systematic, maybe take a neighborhood or a census tract or something. Take areas and do a systematic study of the conditions of the properties and take appropriate action rather than waiting on someone to call on the telephone. That avoids a lot of problems, including the appearance that you're just being arbitrary and you're picking on people because some squeaky wheels are out there in the community. I think I have one more. Any questions?
We don't, but what we would like to do, I know that there will be questions, if you can just allow Rock Hill and Greenville and Clemson to make some brief comments, then we'd like to open it up, and I'm sure there'll be more than a few questions for you.
Okay, I almost complied with your time.
Very appreciated. And when we have someone with Attorney Meggs' experience, we hope that all of you will take this opportunity when we open it up to questions to further any line of inquiry with him. We'd like to now just open it up for brief comments to talk about some experiences in Rock Hill and Greenville, and then we'll turn to Clemson, and then we'll open it up first to the Council of Neighborhoods and then to the audience for any questions that you may have. Robin Joas is with us from Rock Hill with Jean Branch. Robin?
Yes. Thank you for having us here today. We've enjoyed the tour of the city. Really impressed with what we saw, especially with one inspector. Housing Neighborhood Services, the Inspections Division, we have five inspectors that work our city, and we have one demolition coordinator, and we have to have an admin person to help us manage everything because we are a proactive organization. Up until then, we were handling about 406 calls a month before we went proactive. But as the attorney mentioned, things do kind of become, you know, you pick in a certain area or the people that complain, and then we find too much of what we would consider blighted conditions in neighborhoods where we could really help them out. One thing that we have is five zones that we work out of. So we've split our city up into five zones and we attack it systematically. We have excellent tools that help us do our job. We have a complaint tracking system, which is imperative. It pulls from our GIS and our utility accounts so that we can actually send letters to people of ownership and people of utility tenants, that they will also get the letters. We have a very active demolition program. Last year we did 43 demolitions. Some of that was from the NIP, the Neighborhood Initiative Program. It was the U.S. Treasury's hardest hit funds. We applied for those grants and we were awarded over $630,000. So we were able to knock down 19 properties, and we're still continuing to knock those down this year. As a result of that, and some NSP money, the Neighborhood Stabilization Program, we were able to take some down as well. So any grant opportunities we get, we have an outstanding grant division that's always looking for us and making sure that we can get whatever programs we can so that it helps us do our job better. Our demolition program is the International Property Maintenance Code. We do enforce that completely, but we do have our own demolition ordinance because Orangeburg cases scare us. So, and it's from Title 31 as well. So it's ironclad. It's pretty solid. We haven't had any pushback whatsoever. We have an outlined process that our attorneys put in place for us to follow, from writing the letters to the ordinances to the order that we submit to hearings that we require for someone on that demolition track to come in. And another thing that we do is if someone comes into a hearing and says that they would like to rehab their property, this is their opportunity. And the code official, which is Jean Branch here with me for the IPMC and for our municipal demolition program, he was appointed as our code official, but it's up to him to determine if what they tell him at that hearing, if this can proceed on with maybe a commitment to repair so that we can get this done with a commitment. And we may enter into one of those and give them a certain timeline to get permits started, and as long as progress continues, because it's not our intent to tear down a house. It's not our end goal, or enforcement for that matter. We are asking for compliance on these cases. And along with the International Property Maintenance Code, a lot of times we find these demolition properties are the ones that are the boarded properties. And we do have an amendment to the International Property Maintenance Code, because that's what allows us to board, but it doesn't tell us how to maintain them after they're boarded. So we have a provision of 6 months for boarding. Commercial, of course, there's exemptions as long as you keep your properties up and that type of thing to allow you to keep those boarded. But you have to, the exterior should look good. Otherwise, the grass should be cut. It's basically that boarding amendment also deals with our vacant properties, because the intent behind a vacant property is for it not to stay vacant or remain vacant, because those are the ones that become victim of graffiti tagging, the rock throwing through the windows, and then you have your landlord that says, but I just replaced those windows, and can I board it? We only allow them to board it for 6 months so that they can get it habitable again to put back on the market. If not, the boards have to come off, and we're okay with it sitting there vacant if you can't get anybody in it and you don't have the money to fix it, as long as the exterior looks good. It's got to look habitable, even if it's not habitable. So that's some of the things that we work on. We have windshield surveys that we do once a quarter. What we will do is we'll go out into the entire city limits and we will tag and inventory everything that we see that's a code violation. It's through a program called Mobile 311, and it's tied to our GIS, so we can then create work orders for our inspectors to go out into the field and spot those violations that whoever we designated to do it this time around to take care of those. And that's a really effective tool for us, I think, because you get complacent when you're in your own neighborhoods, and you don't always hit every street in your zone. You go to the problem areas, but then you see things that maybe that inspector's not seeing day in, day out as they're maintaining their workflow. The last year, we had 4,026 completed code violations as a result. Before we went to five zones, we had four. We were completing about 2,700. And some may say, oh, it's getting worse, but I had stated many times, no, we became more efficient and were able to spread that out. One person didn't acquire 1,300 cases. It was spread out more. You can cover more area, and you can get more work done as a result. Until 2005, we had only completed 24 demolitions ever, and to date, we have completed 630 demolitions in the city of Rock Hill. And there again, our housing inventory is very important to us, and we want to protect it. We do not look at code enforcement as punitive. We look at it as preserving what we have, keeping people in their homes, and making it viable. Viable living product. Another thing that we did this year that we took on was looking at rental regulations, and we did look at Clemson's rental regulations, but in order to have a landlord licensing regulation, we had to have the data to support it, because our council has never been in favor of such an ordinance, or that just for our landlords. But when we did some analytics and started comparing correlations between crime, fire and code enforcement, where were you most likely to have a crime occur, fire potentially, or a code enforcement issue? We had some telltale signs, neighborhoods we knew would pop up, but we had the data to support it. So we engaged in a landlord licensing regulation as a pilot project for an area that was over 80% of the code violations that came out of there were from rental locations. So other than this opportunity for housing inspections, we typically do not get inside of a residence. What we do is exterior. We do property exterior only, windshield view, or once we're on the property for that windshield view, then we can go around the exterior of it. But unless somebody called because a landlord was negligent and not taking care of the property, we didn't get inside. But this is an opportunity for us to get inside before one's rented only. It's not for occupied locations, and it's only for life safety issues. So we began this in June, so it's a test pilot. We'll see where it goes. We're excited about it. It is not behavioral intent so much as it is about life safety and having livable, habitable spaces. So, and if it goes well, we hope that we will have a landlord license and regulation throughout the city limits for rental properties. I hope that was helpful.
That was very helpful. Thank you, Robin. And Robin and Jean will stay with us to answer any questions or respond to your comments when we are through. Next, we have from Greenville, we have Brad Rice, and we've asked Brad to talk about a few of his experiences in this regard in Greenville. And lastly, through the miracle of technology, we'll be hearing from our friends from Clemson. And very specifically, when we talk to Clemson, we want to ask them about their experiences about their rental ordinances, which are as tough as we've seen. If you just point that and talk, it's directional, so it'll start picking up.
Okay. All right, thank you. Thank you for having me again. Just a little background about myself. Again, my name is Brad Rice with Greenville, South Carolina. I'm the code enforcement supervisor there. I've been with the city 21 years now. Started out with the fire department. I moved to the fire marshal's office in 2000, and then 2004 moved to the building department, where I'm currently at now. We started with the property maintenance code back when it was first adopted in 2000 with the fire department, and we've adopted it ever since. We've just now adopted the 2015 version, which there's not a whole lot of change. As Mr. Beck says, there's not a lot of change in there, but we have to keep getting the new books every year. We try to be more proactive as well as Rock Hill. We do have a complaint-driven system. It's called Greenville Cares. People can call in that number with any kind of complaints they like or want to. They can do it anonymously if they like. They don't have to give their name. And usually that will come in our system and it will come to me. And then I can give it out to a specific inspector for that area. I have three inspectors with different areas. We have four areas, which I take the downtown area. It's a little bit more, I'll say political, but the downtown area is a very important area that they want to see. So me being the leader of my people, I go after that pretty hard myself. So my inspectors have their areas. They're split up into four different places. Once they do get their complaints in the morning, I do send them out with the idea that if you see anything, just don't go straight to your complaint and turn around and come back and go to the next complaint. If you see something while you're out there, hit it, go for it, write it up, do what we have to do. Right now, I guess some of the biggest issues that we're dealing with right now, of course, is grass, like with everyone. Our height limit for grass in the city of Greenville is 10 inches all the way around. If it gets above 10 inches, then that is in violation, and we'll have it written up. Cars are a big deal. Within the city of Greenville, it has to be licensed and operable. If it doesn't have a license plate on it, for us, it is in violation. And they'll have to either remove it or get it tagged. Derelict houses, boarded up structures, which are boarded, we do the same thing as Rock Hill. We do a 6-month boarding up permit. Once that permit is up, then it either has to be brought into compliance as habitable, or it has to be demolished. If they don't want to demolish it, then we can demolish it ourselves. We had an issue a couple of years ago where we were going through our court systems and getting an order for that, and there was a issue with that, so we have now decided to do everything in-house administratively through our legal department when we demolish a house. I'm the one that does all the demolitions, so me and my boss, who is Buddy Scanner, the building official for the city, we'll go out, look at the house, see what shape it's in, and if it is bad enough for us to demolish, then we will post it, and our legal department will place a list pendants on the property as well. They'll do all their due diligence, and then once they give me the okay, I move straight forward with the demolitions through all my processes, as far as asbestos surveys, asbestos abatements, and then finally the demolition of the property. We usually do pretty good. We go with it. It does take a little bit longer than you used to, but that's not necessarily a bad thing to make sure you got all your due diligence done when you're dealing with this. We also have a fining process as well. We do our own, and we have administrative fees as far as fining process. You're cited more than once in the city of Greenville, you'll get a fine. Second time is $25 a day until the violations are corrected. The third time is third and more is $50 a day until it's violations abated. If you with grass and trash, we have our own in-house that we do. Our community or our grounds department does all our work orders that we do as far as grass and trash abatement. I'll send them a work order. They'll send me back the amount of how much ever it cost. I place that with all the other administrative fees, we send that out as a fee dues letter that they are to pay as this, or it goes to a lien. It can get up pretty expensive. I've seen it in the past where for us going out to cut somebody's grass, it costs them $500. So, but what we'll do is we'll place it, if it's not paid within that 30 days, we'll place a lien on the property. And we did go to the set-off debt. So if there's people inside, if you have a South Carolina tax return, then we'll sometimes get our money back on that part. Vacant houses aren't too bad right now for us. We do have the vacant houses that in certain areas that we are working hard on. I'm sure just about everywhere has this problem with vacant structures and people going in and out of them, and we're trying to do our best to get them that way. People do, we'll board them up or we'll put the new windows in, but then of course it all gets broken out unless in there, which we find out is the best way to deter anything is to have someone in your in the house at all times occupying the place. We get a lot of good help from our city council as well. They're the ones who wanted us to do the fine process to begin with. Once we started that, they're the ones who brought it up. They're pretty good about backing us up no matter what we do. If there's any issues we have, mayor, city manager, they're always out there. They're looking to see how we're doing things and just making sure that if we need anything, that we have all the tools. One of the big things I'm dealing with right now is hoarders. I've got a couple of hoarders in my in the city right now, and those two individuals are very difficult to deal with. They think that everything has got some type of something for a reason. They gotta have everything, so they don't want to get rid of anything. So I'm having that problem right now is my biggest obstacle is with these the hoarders going on right now. So we're really getting that one. So the biggest another big thing is that it, with our jobs it takes time. It don't happen overnight. So as long as people and sure that everything gets done in this room. So
thank you, Brad. Very much appreciate it. And lastly, we have Jacob Peabody from Clemson. Jacob is the Zoning and Codes Administrator that oversees zoning, property maintenance, and rental housing programs for the town of Clemson. Jacob?
Hello, everybody. Thank you for having me.
Good afternoon.
We have the standard tools of the International Property Maintenance Code, but we also have two other tools that we have found to be very effective. The city has adopted occupancy limits based on the zoning district, and we have the rental housing program. Although these are three independent ordinances, we do find them to be used in conjunction quite often. In Clemson, if you want to rent a home or even rooms in your home, you must be part of the rental housing program and have a rental housing permit. To get the license, you must have the property inspected every year. The property must be compliant with a specific checklist that's set forth in the ordinance. These are things such as smoke detectors, graspable handrails, functional windows, but also things like no visual defects to the structure, no junk and debris in the yard. We also check occupancy at that time. Now, this program helps keep the properties maintained for the tenant's safety, but also for the visual appearance for the rest of the people in the neighborhood. And it kind of cuts out the whole complaint-based issue because we're there every year, we keep on top of it, you know, we have to keep it up to a certain level of standard, and we have boots on the ground every single year going to these properties. Now, as part of the rental housing program, you have to have a person designated within 75 miles to be the person in charge. So this person is responsible for the property. This helps prevent the absentee landlord who doesn't live anywhere near it and doesn't have anyone, you know, around to manage the property. So if there's any repairs needed, we can call somebody who is close enough to be there within, you know, an hour or two. This, we think engaging the owners in this way, keeping them involved on a, you know, fairly regular interval so they have to do periodic maintenance is one of the keys to how successful our program is. The type of landlord who doesn't want to have anything to do with the property, just wants to collect the rent, don't stay in our city. They sell the property and they move on because it's too much of a hassle for them. But also, our yearly inspections are helpful to the landlords as well, because when we call them up and tell them that they failed their rental inspection because they have 12 people living in the house, or we found barrels of used motor oil in the backyard, a lot of times they had no clue what was taking place in their property, and it actually helped them in the long run. I really think the rental housing program has been our most effective tool with dealing with problem properties. Most of our problem properties are rental properties, and that has weeded out most of the slumlords and just set a standard for all the tenants and everyone that they understand that we are going to be in there on a pretty regular basis and we're going to be keeping an eye on them. So it holds to a high standard. Now, we've found that the same properties that have code violations are the same properties that have issues with the police. compliance, state law, federal law, within a 4-year, within a 2-year time, you have to go in front of the city council for a suspension hearing, at which time your rental housing license can be suspended for up to a year. So the properties that are having loud parties, the properties that are having junk cars in the yard, all those different types of violations are there's a cumulative total to potentially hold the rental license for that property. There is some defense that the landlords do have. If they commence an eviction process and get rid of problem tenants after the third strike, before the fourth strike happens, then they can use that as a defense to try to keep their rental housing license. So it does give a incentive to the landlords to get good tenants. Now, as part of this, though, you have to develop a good program with your police. That is the key to having a successful rental housing program that functions in our way. Right now, the police send me a copy of the call log every day, and I have to go through that to see if any of the properties that have had the police come out to it are part of the rental housing program. If I find that any of the properties are in the rental housing program, I have to then go get a copy of the incident report, and then I have to follow the case all the way through to see if they get a conviction, and at that point they'd be counted as a strike. I'm sure that there is a better way to do a more streamlined way to do this with a computer program, but we have not found a way. Right now, with the SLED requirements for how protected, you know, the police database has to be, we have not found a way that we can just overlay the property information over a GIS or anything like that. They have to be kept separate, the computer databases. So right now we haven't found a more streamlined way, but we're working on that. Now the other part, we do take occupancy very serious in our city. The occupancy has several benefits of having occupancy limits. In most of our neighborhoods, our occupancy limit is 2. So that is 2 unrelated people can live in a house. This has kind of worked for several different reasons. It's actually helped stabilize our housing market. Our housing prices were just going skyrocketing in the neighborhoods because people found they could buy up a 4-bedroom house, rent out each room to several college students, and make more money renting to a group of college students who are willing to pay $500 a bed than to rent to a family or to sell to a family. So we actually was able to stabilize our housing market by putting the occupancy limit into place. It also helped actually create a boom in our higher density areas. So our areas that allow for multi-housing saw a large development after this. After we were kind of forced the students out of our neighborhoods, it resulted in a big building boom of the multifamily housing in the zones where that was encouraged. And this was seen as a good thing. It actually kind of helped our tax revenues and preserved our neighborhoods. Now, I know a lot of these are kind of issues related to college towns, but I think this program can work in other communities. I think it, you know, has in other communities. Now, if you do choose to implement the rental housing program, one similar to ours where it requires, you know, yearly inspections and bringing the homes up to a certain level of compliance, the first 2 years of implementation are very difficult. They, you know, they're very taxing, they require multiple inspections, and this is either going to require an increase in staff or hiring on a private inspection firm as an as-need basis to do inspections. So there are different companies out there who are capable of handling doing inspections. If you don't want to hire on a permanent employee, there is options out there. Now, identifying the properties that are rental properties was not difficult in our community. We were able to use the tax assessor's database, and if your county has the GIS capabilities, they should should be pretty easy for them to produce a list of all the rental properties. So identifying the properties was not that hard. Bringing them into compliance, a lot of them did have to go to court and, you know, be forced into complying with the ordinance of actually getting a permit. But after the first 2 years, it tends to run fairly efficiently. You know, most of the major issues, obviously there's still upkeep issues. We go out there, we still find things have rotted, you know, there's junk in yards, that type of thing. But it tends to run pretty smoothly. It can actually even turn into a revenue source that helps fund other enforcement programs. Now, that brings in the issue of absentee landlords. What if, you know, the person with dilapidated property doesn't live anywhere nearby? Getting service on them can be challenging, can be quite difficult. If you can track them down, you can hire a process server in another state to deliver the citation. This does cost money, but is a way to get legal service to them and have them appear in court. Sometimes you can't find them at all, and at that point, you know, that's when you get some the hard decisions of, are you going to go in there and clean up the property and put a lien against it? You know, the International Property Maintenance Code does allow for you to do that, so that is an option. There is cost involved, so the city has to make that decision. We've actually had some success with talking to neighbors, that we have these houses that no one's living in. Sometimes the neighbors will just go out there and mow the front yard just to keep it looking good. That's not something you can really force on anyone, but it's nice when the neighbors get together and do that. We've also had we've had issues where there was no clear owner of properties. There was not a clear title. We couldn't find who was the legal owner. Now, if you can find somebody who says that they may have ownership, we have been successful with putting them in touch with South Carolina Legal Services. They'll provide, if the person is income eligible, they'll provide free legal services for civil matters, non-criminal matters, and they've actually helped people get clear title where there wasn't a will, it got passed down to multiple, you know, there was no clear ownership until someone went through the process of actually clearing title. And that's actually helped us with several of our dilapidated properties in town, because the only reason why nothing was happening was there was arguments over who owned it. There was no clear ownership. So putting people in touch with the services that are available, it can actually be a helpful tool as well. Now, I used to work in a municipality in Rhode Island. Rhode Island had a state law that allowed us to, once a property was condemned, we could keep raising the taxes on them every year until they did something with the property. This would require a change in the legislation here in South Carolina, but it's something I would advocate for. It was very effective, and again, produced a revenue stream that helped the municipalities do more enforcement. So I know that was a quick presentation, but I think I'd like to open up for any questions or however you guys want to handle this.
Well, thank you very much, Jacob, and if you can stay with us, I'm sure there will be questions or comments that we would appreciate your perspective on. Thank you, Jacob. And having said that, I'd like to turn to the leadership of the Aiken Council of Neighborhoods for any questions that they might have, and then we'll open it up to the audience. As one who has now spent the entire day with officials from Rock Hill and Greenville in our conversations with Clemson's, it's hard not to conclude, to come to several conclusions. The first is, even discounting the variances in population, obviously Rock Hill's about twice the size of us, Greenville's much bigger, even taking that into consideration, these communities have larger staffs to do the day-to-day workings of these functions. They clearly have more staff than we have in Aiken. And the second conclusion that is hard not to hard to miss is that their ordinances are tougher. and we can talk about that, but clearly looking at Rock Hill, clearly looking at Greenville, clearly, really clearly looking at Clemson, they have additional tools. They have tougher ordinances, and the real challenge for us in Aiken is whether we want to visit that and to what extent. But those are the several conclusions that we've drawn in our short visit with these communities. They have larger staffs, they have tougher ordinances, and that's the challenge that we need to work with the council on in addressing. Having said that, Gary Yount, Beth Copenhaver, and Ann Dix are with the Council of Neighborhoods, and I would turn to them to see if they have any questions.
Could I jump in really fast and clarify something?
Sure.
Okay. We had talked about, Gary had talked about in our ordinance that we do have a section 10-13 on registration, and I'm really glad that we have that, but it doesn't seem to be getting us quite where we want to be. And would each of you three go through again how you get your landlords to register, and if they don't register, then what happens? Would you mind to do that, please? Greenville and
mine's gonna be quick. We haven't gotten that far yet, so we don't really do that yet.
Okay, great. And
Rock Hill.
For Clemson, we will do a uniform ordinance summons to take them to court if they do not comply with, if they do not register.
And Jacob, how do you know that you're not missing some folks? How do you know that there aren't landlords out there and you're just missing them?
Well, that can be a challenge. Usually, a neighbor will complain if it's a rental property, because everyone in our community is very aware of, you know, our rental housing ordinance. But we have we check the tax assessor's database to see if it's 6% or 4%.
Mm-hmm.
That is our most common way.
Okay, and we've talked about that here too. And Rock Hill.
The great thing that we have is we are a utility provider, so that everything is linked through our utilities. In order to get that utility turned on for a new tenant, because we're not inspecting those that are already occupied unless they go vacant. So as far as that registration, we will get those for if it's turning over for tenancy. But we haven't gotten to the point where our October 31 deadline's approached for those who have not registered yet, but it's a $250 fine, and it'll be through the municipal court.
Okay.
So, and if we have trouble finding folks, we'll, you know, go through the processes of locating at that time, especially if they've got a rental unit and somebody's in it, they're paying rent to someone. So we'll track it down.
Okay. Thank you.
Garrett?
I'd like to thank all of you for coming out today, especially those of you who traveled to get here. One question I'd like to ask the three of you. What kind of support do you get from your city council? Do you get backlash? Do you get pushback? Or do they support what you're trying to do?
By and large, our ordinances are in place because we have strong staff and strong council leadership. I think that's first and foremost, because we wouldn't be where we are today without that leadership and that intuition to know where we were heading, and a lot of these ordinances have been in place for a while, unlike our demolition ordinance and things like that. Those have come about, and they've supported them wholeheartedly. But there are times where we call it the pendulum, and it swings, and we're aggressive, and then we're asked to step back a little. We're asked, someone may complain that they think our penalties are harsh, and then we're asked to take a look at our penalties, and things of that nature. You're always trying to please. You're trying to please your constituents, I'm sure, at that level. But at the same time, then you think about hardships and how punitive our fines and fees can be. So I understand that dynamic that tries to take place there. But without a strong ordinance that you feel comfortable that you can put into place and administer it fair and equitably to everyone, because we also have our ethics involved as well, that if we're out there enforcing these ordinances, we want to do it fairly and equitably, and everybody is subjected to them. So that's where the challenge make sure you write something that you can live by.
Any comments from Clemson or Greenville on that?
Sure. Yeah, we do find that the ordinance does need to be tweaked, or council members will feel that certain measures of it are not how they'd like it, and it does get revised from time to time. In general, they are very much in favor of our rental housing ordinance. The number of complaints has gone down just exponentially since it's been implemented. So just not having the constituents call up complaining about grass, junk and debris, junk and that type of thing, paid its dividends, and the council is very supportive of our ordinance.
Right.
We get a lot of backing from our city council. They're 100% behind us. As I stated earlier, they're the ones who pretty much thought up the finding process that we go through now. It's been tweaked a little bit, but it works out great. If we need anything, I guess up to a monetarily point, I guess, suppose, you know, just be, they'll give us anything we need.
Ann, do you have anything?
No. The question that I'd like to ask each of you, who said that they use plexiglass? I know Rock Hill does not board, right? So it must be good. Was it Green?
Someone was saying. Mr. Meggs.
Mr. Meggs, was that you that suggested about the plexiglass? Does that help?
I've been gone from Columbia for, 7 years. And my information comes secondhand through the code enforcement officials in Columbia, so I can't answer your question. I don't know how efficient the plexiglass program has been in Columbia, and I'll try to get that information for you and pass it along.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, it is your turn. I see Council Member Duar has a question, so feel free to come up so your voice will be captured for the video. We appreciate that. Council Member Duar.
I do thank you all for coming. Two questions. Are you, any of you concerned with parking on the lawns or parking on grass in front of the house? And we've all talked about the housing. Could you address your issue with commercial landlords? Because we have, I know, commercial rental owners that aren't maintaining codes. So how do you deal with your commercial properties?
Good question.
Who would like to?
As far as the commercial, we treat them just the same way as we would with the residential. We do send them their notices. If they don't do what we ask, we fine them as well. So to us, the commercials no different. We also, at one time, now we did let the commercial, if they wanted to board up, it was for as long as they wanted to. Within the last year and a half, we've changed that, and now they can only board up anything for 6 months as well. So we're getting to where we're just treating them just the same as we would anybody else as far as residential.
Okay, and the question about parking on Rock Hill, Robin?
Yes.
Parking on the lawn is in the zoning ordinance, but this past year what we've done is we took on all zoning for residential, zoning enforcement, and we split the responsibility of doing commercial will now go to the Planning and Development Services. The zoning inspector will do the enforcement on those. But like Greenville, we treat them the same if it's commercial, residential. The caveat with parking on the lawn is a little bit of one of those in our newer neighborhoods is so easy to enforce. Because you can catch it early before it really takes a foothold into the community. But when you have old town areas of your city where when they were developed they didn't have a formalized driveway, or it's kind of hard to paint the whole city with that one paintbrush. So we realize that we do have certain instances where we're not going to get the result that we want in some of our old town areas, but we absolutely try to stay on top of it in our newer developments, the areas that's never had the issues. use. And you typically will see that happen as like a change of ownership or a change of tenancy, and that's when it happens, or around our college campus. Sometimes we have had to go through right after the students move in and kind of handle those situations and get those new students in line as they start their new year with us. But we absolutely do care about it because it does contribute to, you know, property values and sales of your homes and what the exterior of that property looks like. So it is important to us.
Jacob?
Clemson also follows very similar to Rock Hill. We do not. You have to park on improved surface. You're not allowed to park within 25 feet of the street. But there are properties that are older that are grandfathered in, per se, for that. So that can be a challenge, but we do consider it to be an important thing. And commercial buildings get treated the same way as residential as far as maintenance.
Other questions or comments? Yes, Councilmember Diggs.
Good afternoon. I thank y'all for being here, and I thank ACON for organizing this workshop. Actually have some things to say in regards to what you are doing right, which, Robin, I love the fact that you got a lot of grant money. Want to know how you got all that money. Y'all stay pretty busy. You have 400 calls a month. Is that what you said?
No, ma'am, that was before we went proactive.
Okay.
We get 400 calls a month. Now we're
okay.
Proactive. Those numbers have come down. 15% is falling.
Very good. Who writes your grants?
Grant administrator. We have grant writers. We have a team of about four or five very talented individuals, and they are on the team. So they know it's out there. They're trying for it.
And they're fortunate enough to have five inspectors where we have just one. Poor Teddy. We tried to fix that, though, because we don't like it at all. Brad? Who's Brad? Brad. Hey, Brad. How are you? You said you had a program called Greenville Cares, and it's like an anonymous hotline or something where people could call in. Do you see an increase in reporting because this is anonymous?
People know that they want
to give their name.
I had someone call me today and said their neighbor's grass is about
7 feet in the backyard in Crosland Park on Cornish Drive. Gary, I know you'll ride by and look at it. And I think Teddy went out there a few weeks ago and took care of that property. I think it's at 1133 Cornish. And if that person is here, yeah, I called you out. You can cut your grass. Your neighbor's scared that snakes crawling everywhere. But they were afraid to tell me. The caller was afraid to identify themselves. So we might have to set up a hotline or something so that people can call in and not be afraid to identify themselves. And then Jacob.
Yes.
Not a Clemson fan, but you're okay.
Carol.
No Gamecocks. Anyway, you said, I like this, that you require that there's an inspection every year.
Yes.
I love that. We need to do that. I think a lot of the landlords definitely don't know what's going on their properties. When you pass a property and I see the same debris, the same furniture out in the yard that's been there for 2 years and nothing's been done, it's evident that they have not a clue. I love the fact that you make it landlords stay too within a 75-mile radius, so if they need to come and clean up the property quickly, they can get there in an hour or two. That's something very, very good. And I just like a lot of things you're doing in Clemson. But I just want to, someone said, I think it was you, Brad, about the citations. The first time, it's $25. The second time, it's $50.
Per day.
Daily fees. Okay. So, If you go out one day and there's a... Y'all do the junk cars, too?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. I can't stand those. So if you go out and you serve a citation, okay, and that first day it's $25, you let them know that if that car is not gone the next day, it's going up to another $25, we need to do that. I know it's harsh.
It is hard.
But we got to get rid of these cars.
Don't you need to get them to the time frame?
Well, you know, you've got people that you've done that for.
Well, I'm talking about the first time. I'm talking about the first time.
Well, yes, we can.
Come up with a notice, and then we can. I think people should have a period of time to get it before they start getting hit. Like, you've got 48 hours. You've got some amount of time.
They got 30 days to it.
Okay.
Now, the second time we're written up for the same violation is when we start the
time. I agree.
Ted, I've got two in my neighborhood, two different houses that's had cars in the yards, and they have been served, and they're still here a year later.
Well, then we increase. I still agree.
Yes.
Got to give them a little bit of a time.
A year is a long time for me to look at that. It is.
Yeah, I agree.
But I just thank y'all so much for being here, and I thank y'all
thank you, Council Member,
for hosting this meeting.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Yes, Ms. Burns?
I do. And that's going back. Catherine Burns, and I'm going to question for you,
because I think that we're responding on the squeaky wheel process here. And I've been working on a property to get it cleaned up, and we're probably on about 7 weeks now. And there's been some improvement, but it's still there. Now it is vacant. We have had vandalism. We have had theft. Anyone driving by the area is going to say, no, I don't want to rent here. Anyone's properties that are for sale, people are going to say, no, I don't want to live here. So my question is, and I believe we do need to give people a certain amount of time to make the repairs and then begin hitting them with penalties. But you say, I don't think we have a system here. So once you tag a property, do you tag a property and then send a letter? And what is your procedure after that? Because I think we're missing that here in Aiken.
One of the things that we've done, one of the, like when we were talking about pushback earlier, is like instead of that notice of violation, our council, I think they wanted us to have a softer, gentler approach. So we started a courtesy notice and advised, hey, we're coming back within 30 days. This is not for grass, mind you. This is not for yard debris. This is not for junk derelict vehicle. Those we give a 10-day notice, and that's a courtesy if it's their first time. After that, we give them a notice of violation that's a 10-day, and then we can take them to court, or we could tow that vehicle out of the yard once we've noticed them on that vehicle. So that's, and we've partnered with a tow service. There's nothing in it for us. Once it leaves that lot, it's the tow services, and it's your problem with the tow service. But so we have these letters set in place, these notices set in place for structure violations specifically. It just depends on how bad they are. When people begin processes of doing the repairs, or if we certify them into one of our programs, a lot of our owner-occupied, whenever it's a problem, these folks, it's not intentional that they're not fixing up their property. Sometimes it's because they can't afford to, and like for a roof or and things of this nature, so, or just the painting, because that's one of the things we do cite. So if we can qualify them in our Roland and Rock Hill program, then we will stop the enforcement action saying they're approved Roland and Rock Hill. If it's part of the Housing Development Corporation's funds, it's CDBG funds that we get a grant for every year. If they qualify to go on that list, they come off my enforcement list. So we know there's a resolution coming. We just got to wait it out and wait for those funds to be available and for that work to begin. But there is a process. We do have a court process. Our fines can be $1,087.50 per day once it goes to court, and or 30 days in jail.
Or does it fall under IPMC? Under IPMC?
Yes,
It's a general provision. International Property Maintenance Code is adopted under the municipal ordinance. And then we have the municipal codes that we also enforce. And then zoning has its own regulations. Mm-hmm. But they're all back through the general penalty of our municipal code, which is for us 1-11. And it says if you're guilty of a misdemeanor crime, it's $500 penalty. But we know with court costs, it's $1,087.50 or 30 days in jail. And each day is a separate offense. So we're using general penalty. But we are, like Greenville, looking at some fine options and looking at, instead of setting that, maybe actually putting in nuisance code violations at potentially maybe $100 to start at the court, instead of going in there, having them a ticket, because it's up to $500. So we can set those parameters as long as we do it fairly and equitably, and we have a system and a process that we can all agree with as our starting point.
Thank you, Robin. Other comments or questions?
I have a question.
Yes, Council Member Price.
Thank you so much. And Courtney, thank you for facilitating this along with the neighborhood associations, but also to Greenville and to Rock Hill and to Clemson and to, who else is here, Columbia area, and our citizens that are here as well. Mm-hmm. Homeless.
Yes, ma'am.
How do you all handle that? Because some of these folks have been in your abandoned structures. What do you do about that? You don't have any homeless problems in your area.
Not in Blythewood yet.
Okay.
Columbia, most assuredly.
So how do you handle these individuals that have been in the abandoned structures? Is there a place for them? They just have to find the next place to go, is that?
Well, the homeless problem is, that's a toughie. And Columbia City Council is wrestled with that for decades. We have facilities downtown. You may be familiar with the Gospel Mission.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a wonderful mission there and have been there since the 1800s. They have their detractors. There are some who would say they're part of the problem because we have those folks that they're serving right in the heart of Columbia, and some folks don't like that. I happen to be a contributor to, I can say this now since I'm no longer attached to the city, but I happen to be a contributor to the Oliver Gospel Mission. I think they do a wonderful task, and we have to take care of those that are less fortunate somehow. But it's a tough nut, and there is a segment of our population, frankly, like to be homeless and live that, whatever that lifestyle is. And gosh, so we've got Oliver Gospel, we've got another facility there at the corner of Maine and Elmwood. It's a fairly new structure there. What was it used to be? We have church-affiliated groups. Does a tremendous service. There may even be Christ Central operations in 18, perhaps. It's a fairly widespread organization. But to say that there's
a place for
specific strategy, well, you know, there are places,
right,
and there are resources. In fact, the city ran a winter homeless shelter for some years, may still run that once the temperatures hit a certain threshold. Then there is a facility close to the Columbia Canal that provides a warm place for folks to stay. But to say that there is a magic bullet out there to deal with this problem is that's a long shot.
Greenville, how do you manage that?
Leslie, could you handle the mic? Because they won't pick them up. They won't be able to hear them.
The same way we have the Salvation Army, Miracle Hill Ministries, they have places, Train Mercy Centers, a church, same thing like that, that they can go to. Like Jim says, it's very difficult. I mean, some of them want to go there, but a lot of them don't want to.
But I'm speaking of families. There are families that we are working with that are homeless.
They can go to those places like that, especially the families.
And Rock Hill.
Good
When it comes to our abandoned structures, I think we have a bigger issue that we have to follow through, because it's life safety not only for the people who enter those structures, it's life safety for the people that are adjacent to those structures. So we want them out of those structures, because that's where we see fires. We see them trying to live comfortably throughout the winter, and we would rather encourage them and push them out of those and placard those abandoned structures to get them moving to services, because like you said, there's a good group that's not going to go to those services. But if we can keep them out of areas that's going to harm potentially other properties and themselves by, you know, freezing temperatures and things like that, and the risk of fire is much higher whenever they're in these abandoned properties.
I will say, and Robin, we do have agencies, and our inspectors keep a list of agencies. Our first thing is to try to find a family. We have agencies like Family Promise, so we do try to find. It's not that we want to put everybody on the street. I think Robin's right. We sometimes, it's just not safe to be there, but we do try. Our first attempt is to try to find somewhere for them to go. And it's not always accepted, but that's our first choice.
My last question deals with the facilities. Some of these homes have been left by family members to individuals, to family members. And based on their income, they cannot afford to rehab those structures immediately. Is there a timetable? Is there an... How do you work with those inherited properties where you've got a mother or family making $8 an hour, right, and they're doing the best they can to keep their current dwelling up to par, but yet they've got this house that was left by a mom or dad or a family member that they want to hold on to, but it's derelict. It needs work. How do you handle that?
Well, if it ends up falling into our demolition criteria, we will work with them, hopefully through a voluntary demolishing program where they can keep the land free, mm-hmm, no liens on their property, and we'll bring this thing down. I think it's more important to hold on to that land, because if you make $8 an hour, you're never going to rehab it.
Exactly.
It's just the reality of it.
And that is what we're dealing with a lot in our community. We have inherited properties by family members that are sitting. Naturally, family members want to keep it in the family, but they cannot afford to rehab those properties. And I think we're going to be met with a lot of those issues. Are you all the same thinking that that's how you handle it in your areas?
Yes, ma'am. We had inventory of air property in Columbia, same types of circumstances, very unfortunate, and that's probably the best result is that the voluntary process with no lien. Sure.
Same. Okay. Thank you, John.
Thank you, Councilmember Price. Gary, yeah. I have a question for Robin. Excuse me. You said in a conversation, in our working conversation, that City of Rock Hill has a trial ordinance that highlights or spotlights one particular area. And I suspect Mr. Meggs may have to weigh in on this as well. Could you talk about your ordinance, and can you tell us if we can do that?
That's the pilot rental ordinance that we have, the rental regulations ordinance. And at this point, we don't have an expiration date on it, but we are to report back to council by December of this year of how we are looking. At this point, Gene here has done probably a dozen inspections, and half of those have failed, the first inspection, on basic life safety, whether it's wiring or a smoke detector, that type of thing. And we noticed during the implementation of this ordinance, we had about 14 roofs get put on rental homes. So is it making an impact? Yes. We really won't have anything to report until we get a little further along. We know that we have obtained at least half of our registrations at this time. So we'll know more a little toward December, but at this point, half of them not meeting life safety issues. I'm anxious to see what all the other ones are going to reveal. I think it's very important that we keep going and keep getting that support and that they're supportive of us.
Mr. Maggs, can we target one area with an ordinance, or does it have to be in general for the entire city?
Well, I certainly wouldn't want to take on a challenge of my friend Paul Dillingham, the city attorney in Rock Hill. Paul's probably been city attorney in Rock Hill longer than I was city attorney in Columbia. So maybe I ought to just defer to Paul. Obviously, there's an issue there, whether we could pick a discrete area and apply this ordinance. I'm not familiar with the ordinance. Robin gave me a little bit of an overview earlier before this session started. I wasn't here for the earlier festivities, so I'm really not sure exactly what's going on there, but obviously immediately the hackle would go up and I would have to do some page turning in thought before I would be able to render an opinion for you on whether you could pick and choose. Perhaps the better approach would be to make it citywide and then select an area to initiate your first wave of enforcement and see how that worked out. But again, don't want to take on Paul, so I'll pass.
Thank you both. Other questions or comments? Yes, ma'am.
My name is Gail McClain. I would like...
Gail, could you join us, please? They're not going to be able to hear you at home.
Oh.
Sorry about that. Please.
Okay. I'm very intrigued by the rental housing license program. How do we implement something like that in Aiken? I think we need it. And how do we go about doing that?
One of the very direct charges that the council made to us is that we explore what's worked in other communities and with the expectation that as early as at your next council meeting on September 11th during the workshop that we would begin the process of making recommendations. First question is, there are many varieties of rental ordinances right in this room. I mean, and outside this room, there are very many iterations of an ordinance. So the question is, in the first instance, what makes sense for Aiken? We need to discuss that, and we need a lot of citizen input, property owner input before that final recommendation is made to the council. And then the direct question that you asked is, how do we implement it? And that will be part of our recommendation to the council. And so, not knowing exactly what iteration we're going to recommend, it's hard to suggest how, at this point, that we're going to implement that. But that'll ultimately be a decision of our city council after we've made a recommendation to them. The first question is, what do we want it to look like? And then the second question is, how do you implement it? And we have a very clear mandate by our council to figure that out and get a recommendation before them as soon as possible. Other questions or comments? Beth?
Well, just one comment that I know from my neighborhood, that we also have to think about the county and the city. We still have donut holes in the city, that in our neighborhood we can have one property, a donut hole, that property is under totally different rules, and you'll go by and there are junky cars and there are all overgrown limbs on the house and everything, and yet it's not breaking the county regulations. And then right next to it is a city property and they're doing the same thing, and we can do something about it. So I commend our council, city council, for trying to close those donut holes, but that remains being a problem when that exists, the donut holes.
Thank you, Beth. Yes, sir.
One quick question. Your point is well taken on abandoned properties. I'm from Woodward Estates. We have a piece of property there, in essence, has been abandoned. The order had to be removed medically for medical reasons by public safety personnel, and subsequently abandoned the property. He's gone. the brother who signed over as power of attorney, we've been told, has turned it back over to the bank, washing his hands of it. The entire surrounding of the house is littered with trash. The garage is full of trash. The house is full of trash. There's food stuff, there's automotive parts, there's fallen trees, broken windows, open windows, and it's been sitting like that for 4 months. What can we do to get somebody to square it away? We'd like to go over and cut the grass, but we're afraid we're going to get cited for trespassing.
Well, it's rather an unfair question. Let me just repeat it. You have a situation where there's been and I'm just repeating it for folks that are going to watch this. Okay, so the question is, there's been an abandoned property for 3 or 4 months, and it's growing. There's growing frustration in the neighborhood. The question is, what can be done about it? Now, we could ask Rock Hill and Greenville and Clemson what they were doing in their city, but I might ask Mike Jordan to address that, and if you can do that quickly, that's fine, and if not, if you'd like to meet with Mike Jordan, you just raise your hand, Mike. He's right in the back of the room. He's our building commissioner. He could point you in the right direction. Do you just want to briefly, are you familiar with this property?
No, sir, I'm not.
Okay.
And I think, in all fairness, what we should do is I'd be more than happy to meet you in the office and get that information. I'm not sure if we've actually worked or received a complaint about it.
Okay. Sir, if you could meet with Mike right after this meeting, he'd be delighted to meet with you on this property. Any final questions or comments? Yes, ma'am.
I do have a question.
Could you join us?
This is a question for all of you, and it is in regards to properties in Austin. They're apartment buildings, and we know that there is drug activity in these apartment buildings. And recently there's been something with UPS, which I'm not here to talk about the merits of it, where they're being held accountable for possible drugs being sent via UPS. And my question is, what can be done to the owners of these apartment complexes where there is known drug activity to help, one, get evictions of those people and help move these drugs out of these areas? So if you own an apartment complex, you know there's drug dealing going on in this complex, what responsibility can we place on the owner who, if he or she is at all involved in their property, is going to know this activity is going on? So is any teeth there in any of your areas?
So in Rock Hill and Greenville and in Clemson, the question is how you deal with properties where there is known drug activity.
Can I handle that one first?
Sure, go right ahead, Jacob.
Okay, so if you did have a rental housing program implemented in your city that covered apartment buildings, then if it had a similar framework to the Clemson model where there was the four strikes rule, where if the investigating officer could contribute, you know, a crime had taken place on the property, a notice would be sent to the owner that the crime had taken place, and they'd be notified that it was counted as a strike against their property. And if there was an accumulation of four strikes, so four violations, four criminal activities taking place there, then the property owner could have the rental license for that unit taken away. There's also provisions in there about if the activity is taking place outside, it could be still assigned to a unit if the person arrested was one of the tenants. So if there was a rental housing ordinance, there could be a way to penalize the landlord to make them, you know, accountable and hopefully take action before it gets to that level of them losing their rental permit to rent that unit.
Yes,
Rock Hill.
Okay, and in Rock Hill, we really don't have that type of rental ordinance, what he's talking about at this point there. It was just geared toward life safety with some disclosures to tell the tenants that they shouldn't have any nuisance activity going on their property and that type of thing. But it's up to that landlord. It is between that landlord whether or not they evict or not. There's nothing we could do about it. We are not going to pull their licensing as a result. But one of the things we do is we work closely. I know Gene here with being, if it's not habitable, and if we can determine that it's not habitable, say if they've lost their power or they're not keeping up with those types of requirements, then we can use the International Property Maintenance Code and deem it inhabitable and actually get them out of there. If the police are in a structure and it's in bad shape and they notify us that they saw, you know, electrical wiring hanging and that type of thing, and it's a dangerous situation, and if they notify us once they've entered, then we can also attack it and use each other to help resolve a code violation and maybe take care of the nuisance activity at the same time.
Any last questions?
I have
yes, ma'am.
One comment to Rock Hill. In our discussion, I noticed you said that you used your GPS system and overlay mapping for repeat offenders as when it came to a nuisance property and stuff like that. Is that a system that can be integrated easily within the municipality if they have GIS?
Well, we already have our crime mapping that the police does, and then we have our GIS. I have an open case code map that you could go to live and see all our open cases right now if you wanted to, that the city has. And it's something that our GIS folks did and layer it to kind of tell what's happening. But I can absolutely tell you how many boarded we have, how many overgrown we have. We can do that by ward if we want to, council ward. So if they wanted a map of what's happening in just their area, we could do those things for them. And we do. In our mobile 311, our windshield survey, we can also provide a windshield survey snapshot of what that ward looks like for that council member and what type of code violations take place by and large, so that we can tackle those nuisance type situations head on.
I would like to say that the windshield survey, we actually started out once a month. We drove the entire city of Rock Hill once a month. So we have been able to cut down to once a quarter, and it was really kind of overlapping, but we actually started out every property in the city of Rock Hill someone visited once a month. And, you know, to make sure no stone was unturned, but we have been able to drop that down to once a quarter.
So that means that Aiken needs more manpower then.
Yes, ma'am.
On behalf of all of the citizens of Aiken, I'd like to thank Eugene and Robin and Brad and Jacob for your help. It's been delightful meeting with you today. We've learned an awful lot, and you've really helped us take the first step. To our residents and citizens who care deeply about their neighborhoods and who attended today, we want to thank you for being here. Our next step is to work with our friends from the Aiken Council on Neighborhoods to put together a package. I have been directed by the City Council to have an update to them for their next meeting on September 11th. Issues like staff, that report's going to be very easy to make. It's very objective. You can compare like communities, see what we have for staffing levels, and see how it compares. Ordinances are a little trickier. I mean, we have compiled, and I want to thank Courtney Clyburn Pope, our city solicitor, who has worked in facilitating this whole workshop. It's deeply appreciated. And Courtney's put together a summary document that compares the various ordinances in the three communities as a starting point for us. I know that our city council members are passionate about this. We will be discussing staffing levels, ordinances, and also administrative processes. Are we doing things? Are we responding the way that others in like communities respond? We're looking at those administrative
administrative responses, processes, to see whether they can be improved. So I want to thank all of you for coming today, and as I said, we'll be reporting to the City Council on September 11th during their workshop and making some recommendations. Our administrative staff is present in the back of the room. Feel free, if you have any individual concerns, like the gentleman that raised one, feel free to talk to our staff right now. And I've asked our friends from these communities to stick with us to talk to you personally about any issues that you may have. Thank you very much for coming. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you. Excellent. Excellent.